Well, this is Scott Greer. He's one of the he's one of the very bright generation that emerged in the early aughts in Washington, and which subsequently has been harassed and persecuted and driven out of life by repeated purges and doxings and harassments of various types. But he survived, and he's emerged as a very popular podcaster. He'll explain what he does on the podcast, and also Substacker, a new medium which I simply don't understand and don't want to have to think about. But apparently I'm going to have to think about it. And so Scott's going to explain why. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. You gave me a great introduction. You made me sound like I'm a war refugee. It's like people are hunting me down. It's like Terminator. That's like what's happened. I don't know if it's quite that way, but we'll believe it. Anyway, I have a speech that's going to be about identity issues, the GOP and the conservative media, and how they cover them. And so identity issues refer to those topics that deal with race, national identity, and demographics, mass immigration, affirmative action, anti-white racism, how we deal with American history. All those things deal with the identity issues. And I argue that this should be the chief focus of the American right. Conservative media and the GOP approach these issues in a different way. I'm first going to talk about conservative media. Conservative media has dramatically improved on this front since I've been in politics. When back in 2013, when I started this out, they didn't talk about these issues at all. It'd be a good thing if you heard them say anything about illegal immigration. They're like, oh, wow, this guy is strong against illegal immigration. Because in 2013, they're all beating the drum for amnesty, all how we need to do this to win over more Hispanics and everything of that sort. So big changes since then. And even when I started off with the Daily Caller, you know, this is also an interesting topic, is that they've been more open to certain writers. Like when I was there, I was very careful about to sneak in references to Steve Saylor and Sam Francis. And now, like, people openly champion them. They talk about them in news articles. Like, people are no longer afraid to cite them. So conservative media has improved greatly on the issue of immigration. You will rarely see a major commentator promote amnesty now. They do not promote amnesty. They're very careful about it. And, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they would say, well, immigrants come here and do the jobs Americans just won't do. And they love America more than actual Americans. That was very common for them to say. They're a little bit more circumspect about saying that stuff now. They know that their audience is going to get mad about that. They know that they're going to get blowback from other commentators if they do that. So that's a big improvement. But it's not just an improvement in what they don't say or don't advocate for. Immigration restriction is now a mainstream item in conservative media. Nobody talked about this 10 years ago. Tucker Carlson is largely responsible for that. I think also Trump is also responsible for that as well, for what he talked about in 2016. But Tucker pushed this idea every night on his cable news show host, or maybe not quite every night, but every week. Current Fox News host Laura Ingraham still advocates for this, as well as many talk radio personalities. Restricting legal immigration was hardly ever mentioned in the Tea Party days. I mean, as I said before, all they want to talk about is illegal immigration. Now they talk about legal immigration. So that's a huge improvement. Anti-white racism was a term unmentioned in conservative media just a few years ago. Now it's regularly discussed. Charlie Kirk and Matt Walsh talk about it all the time. And if you guys remember the Groper Wars from 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, you know, people remember that. And everyone went after Charlie Kirk for not wanting to talk about these issues. And now he sounds like the people who are attacking him out of the Groper Wars, because he realized that's what the audience wants. And he talks about anti-white racism all the time. And, you know, both him and Walsh and other mainstream figures who talk about it, they get attacked all the time by Media Matters. They're like, they're talking about a dangerous idea. And still, they don't apologize for it. They still continue to talk about it. So, and even establishment outlets such as Wall Street Journal and the Washington Examiner will talk about anti-white racism. They wouldn't have talked about it a few years ago. And critical race theory, which we all know is just another term for anti-white racism, became a central focus for conservatism and the GOP just a few years ago. And they still talk about it. Not as much as they did in 2021, but maybe they'll come up in the questions that we have afterwards. So, and conservatives frequently mention the Great Replacement, which was an idea they had never even heard of a few years ago. Now they all talk about it. And even if they don't use the term Great Replacement, a lot of conservative commentators will admit that, yes, Democrats want more immigration because they want more Democratic voters. They think that demographic change benefits them politically. So they may not use the term great replacement or may not speak of it in a way that the distant right talks about it, but they will mention the gist of it. So, and Color of Crime has also been surprisingly mainstream. This is largely due to Elon Musk tweeting about it, more so than conservative media. But the fact is that they take a lot of their cues from Elon Musk now. It's the same as they took their cues from Tucker or they took their cues from Trump. And the fact that he's interacting with these accounts and giving them huge engagement on the subject, and conservatives don't want to, you know, back away. And now they'll openly discuss it. And even you could have seen how they were discussing, you know, the hate crimes against Asians a few years ago. You know, everyone in the media would people, I mean, Trump and white supremacy. And most conservative outlets will say, actually, it's a different group of people who are attacking Asians. And now the fact that, you know, it's become mainstream to say, you know, blacks are just 13% of the population, yet commit 60% of the murders. And people would have not wanted to say that openly a few years ago. So it's become popularized. The distant right talking points have become popularized among the mainstream right. And as I said before, this is largely due to Trump and Tucker. But this doesn't mean that conservative ink is perfect. You know, it still has a lot of problems. And the primary problem, I think of it, is now what they focus on. And so they may express support for immigration restriction and condemn anti-white racism, but it's not what they primarily discuss. Right now, the transgender issue and drag queens get far more attention than the border. Those are serious issues. But what is a bigger problem for our country? The fact that we're having millions and millions of people pour in? Or is it that there's, you know, a drag queen story hour in Des Moines? Both are bad. But what you have to say is, like, what's a greater threat to our civilization? But conservatives focus more on the kind of outrageous thing of, you know, drag queens twerking or something, and this gross content, which, you know, gets a lot of attention, but you have to ask is, like, what's important? And so that's also coming out with this, you know, this war on wokeness, which I'm starting to see this disturbing trend where there's a lot of Muslim parents who are going up to these schools and protesting stuff, which is a good thing. But at the same time, they're talking about, oh, base Muslim immigrants. Yes. And it's like all these people in burqas and like they barely speak English. And you're like, well, it's nice that they're protesting. We appreciate that. But at the same time, you know, this isn't necessarily the type of America we want or that we want to champion. But they can't resist the fact that, like, oh, we have another base minority group to celebrate and say that is better than Americans. Once again, they're better on that subject than they were a few years ago. But that's it. And so also there's also the issue of what will conservatives focus on when Tucker is gone. You know, Tucker got removed from his Fox slot, and a lot of these people were taking their cues from Tucker. And Tucker made the great replacement in anti-white racism mainstream. And that's because he was the number one cable news show host. But someone else takes over that throne. Probably somebody, say, like Ben Shapiro. That guy becomes the number one influential voice in conservative media. Then conservatives will then talk about different issues. They won't be talking about dissident right nationalist issues like they were before. So there's that threat, there's that worry that you have to say. Switching gears to the GOP. GOP has also shown some improvement on this front, but not as much as con media. And there's also been some significant backsliding on the GOP. Like conservative commentators, few Republicans will champion amnesty. There are some notable exceptions, like this horrible congresswoman from Florida, Maria Elvira Salazar, who's anytime she's interviewed, she doesn't even know what she's saying. She's like, oh, you know, they're great, you know, and she doesn't know at all what she's talking about, but she's always championing amnesty. But she's one of a handful that will talk about a full-on amnesty. For there'll be a little bit more Republicans who will talk about amnesty for Dreamers and other types, but none of them embrace the type of Gang of Eight amnesty that the majority of the Republican Party, or at least the leadership of the Republican Party, was saying we have to do. So there is an improvement on that. But if you have to see what the majority opinion is, it's absolutely no amnesty. And there was two plans released last year by two establishment guys, Rick Scott and Mike Pence. Neither one of them is anyone's idea of a, you know, hardcore conservative, but both of them had an agenda. And when it talked about immigration, it said absolutely no amnesty. And some of them, or some of the ideas included in the immigration planks they had, set implied that they wanted to restrict legal immigration. So that's a big change. And most Republicans don't discuss immigration restriction, but more bring it up than ever before. J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, and a couple of others have offered concrete proposals to limit immigration, you know, from immigration moratorium, which Vidare was the first to popularize and champion, to the RAISE Act and to a number of other ideas. And a number of Republicans have brought up demographic change as a political weapon used by the Democrats. These include figures such as Ron Johnson and Scott Perry, who have a conservative reputation, and also people like Elise Stefanik, who is not at all very conservative and actually terrible on the issue of immigration. But for some reason, she even implies, you know, that the Democrats are using demographic change for their own gain. There's also some Republicans who are willing to directly call it anti-white racism. Mike Pence, of all people, is one of those figures who would say critical race theory is explicitly anti-white. Some other Republicans, you know, they hedge and haw about this. They don't want to mention it's anti-white racism. They feel that that's too controversial to say. But there are a few who will mention that it's anti-white racism. And Donald Trump also attacks it as anti-white racism. And one of the most surprising figures is Tommy Tuberville, who beat Jeff Sessions. And I think most people in this room were upset about that. But he's turned into one of the more surprisingly keen figures in the Senate about this issue. I mean, he delivered a terrific speech about reparations last year. That was one of the best things I've heard from a Republican talk about reparations, because most Republicans hide behind minorities to attack reparations. And they say, oh, well, you know, it doesn't reward individual gain and those type of things. But, you know, he went up there and he's like, they want to reward those who do the crime. And that's a word we can't repeat on the Vidare stream. But he said that in a political speech. And he's also said a couple of other things, defended, you know, political extremists in the military and other things. And there's a couple of other establishment guys. There's Bill Hagerty in Tennessee, who is also a very establishment guy who's been pretty solid about offering immigration proposals. So those are some things to keep to have a positive outlook on. And state Republicans have also started to target critical race theory in schools and diversity indoctrination in government jobs and universities. Just last week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a ban of DEI offices, diversity, equity, inclusion offices at public colleges in a state. But there are serious weaknesses as part of the GOP. Republicans are more willing to embrace racially woke policies than conservative commentators. And bringing back Governor Abbott, also last week, he signed a Crown Act, which protects black hair from discrimination. I know you guys think that this is one of the most important issues facing our civilization today. And thank God Greg Abbott was there to sign a bill. And he had this horrible signing ceremony. He's around and he's got like a bunch of black lawmakers who clearly don't like him. They're all frowning and he's like smiling. He's like, this is so important. We're banning, you know, discrimination against cornrows and dreadlocks and other things. I think there's been a number of Republicans who signed that. And even Ron DeSantis, who's also one of the more conservative governors there is, maybe arguably the most conservative governor, he's done a lot of stuff about anti-white indoctrination, a couple of different stuff about immigration and, you know, tackling diversity training and other things. He signed into law a requirement for all state public schools that they have to teach Asian American and Pacific Islander history. And now some people, I remember when I reported this on Twitter, some people were like saying, oh, well, they'll teach them that they, you know, they didn't subscribe to victimization or victimhood and they focus on, you know, the classic American values. But that's not what AAPI history courses teaches. As you can look in California's makeup of it, you know, it's all teaching anti-white stuff. It's teaching about how they were discriminated against with the Chinese Exclusion Act, you know, the Japanese internment, you know, colonization of Hawaii and other places. You know, it's about teaching an anti-white framework for American history. And he signed that as a requirement. Now, maybe there's a conservative alternative to it, but the materials that he would likely be based on would be left and woke. It would be what we would say is woke. So these woke lessons will teach the same anti-white lessons as ZRT. It also must be remembered that only 14 Republicans voted against Juneteenth. Which Juneteenth, once again, is about teaching an anti-white framework of American history. You know, only 14 Republicans opposed it, and the Republicans who did oppose it were attacked by their own party as kooky. And also, just a few years ago, most Republicans were still supporting criminal justice reform, but they backed away from it when they saw crime rising after the George Floyd revolution. And Republicans, like conservative media, don't prioritize the identity issues. The big battle in Congress this year isn't over the border. It's over the debt ceiling. Now, once again, the debt ceiling is a problem, but when we're having millions of people pour across the border and you have a one opportunity to push for border security, to push for immigration enforcement, what do? They push the same type of spending cuts that they've always wanted to do, and they're not pushing the important stuff. And they, all these conservatives wasted a ton of their political capital, if not all of it, on this battle. And this is while we're having a full-on invasion at our border. So this is showing some of their, what they're focused on. And this is just harkening back to the heyday of the Tea Party. You know, a lot of these House conservatives and some of that battle was portrayed as, you know, the establishment, business first class versus the Trumpian national populace. But what the hardcore conservatives were fighting for was the same stuff they were fighting for in the Tea Party days, and even the same stuff that a lot of establishment Republicans care about, but they're just using harder rhetoric of some sort. And it's the same also with, you know, there seem to be more of these Republican lawmakers seem to be more worked up about drag queens than illegal immigrants and anti-white discrimination in the workplace. So that's a problem. But comparing the American right of 2023 to the American right of 2013 shows a massive, massive improvement. The state of the right was terrible back then. I was there. Several other people in this room were there. We can all agree it was absolutely horrible. And you just didn't feel like our issues were reaching the mainstream. Now they are. But there's still much room for improvement. More conservatives and Republicans support nationalist ideas than ever before, but it's at risk of being drowned out by other concerns. The goal for true nationalists is to emphasize the identity issues above all other concerns. True. Drag queens and high taxes are unpleasant, but they're not what threaten our civilization. Their great replacement threatens our civilization. And so we have to get Republicans to focus on what matters most. And that's the conclusion of my speech, but we've got plenty of time for questions. I think Peter's got a few questions he wants to ask.
Thank you, Scott. I think I will start off, ask the first question myself. Do tell us about how people can follow you and explain what Substack is.
I'm on Twitter at Scott M. Greer. I'm also on YouTube, youtube.com/highlyrespected. Highly Respected is my show. And Substack, I have highlyrespected.substack.com. Substack can also host podcasts, host articles. It's a great platform for those who are independent of the establishment media and they're wanting to get their voice out. And it's a newsletter, so you sign up for the email and then you get the articles and the podcast delivered straight to your inbox. And several other people who have great ideas, smart writers, are also experimenting with Substack.
Now, so it's free and so it's subscription, right?
Yeah, I have a subscription too. So I have for the podcast I host on Substack outside of the normal Highly Respected, the paywall Substack, our podcasts are called IQ Supplements, and they're medically approved, don't worry. But it's, and your question is an app. It's, I think it has like an app format of it. This is how I don't have the Substack app. This is a huge confession, but most people use it through the emails. They get it straight to their inbox, all the content from that.
What's the percentage?
I think like 5% or so. Oh, yes. What's the percentage of it that they take? I think it's like 15%. That's also another thing. I'm not the best advertiser for Substack. I'm sorry. Sorry to Substack Corporation out there, but.
Now, when do you expect to be banned from YouTube, and are you backed up to Rumble or anything like that?
Surprisingly, I've never gotten a strike from YouTube. It could happen at any moment. If it happens, it'll just go to Substack, go to Rumble. You know, there's Odyssey. There's several other alternatives. So if it happens, it happens, but I can, you know, move around to an other alternative. I let people know through Twitter and through Substack if there's another alternative available.
So you're on Rumble and on Odyssey?
I'm not yet on Rumble, but it's a backup that's ready to be used.
Well, what about your back issues?
Most of the back issues, I have another podcast host that has a hosting platform that has them all.
Okay.
And then I have Substack as well.
I mean, for what it's worth, YouTube banned us without any strikes at all. They just did it.
Yes.
And of course,
they do that a lot. Yeah.
Right. That's what.
Are they still in a banning mode? Can you tell?
Not at this moment, but it can change at any time.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, do we have questions in the audience?
Yeah, we have some over here. Okay. Oh, Mr. Kersey. I love to hear your
long-time listener, first-time caller.
Okay.
Scott, you're really active on Twitter. Your Twitter's fantastic. I recommend if you're not following him, please follow Scott and retweet his stuff. My question to you is, what do you believe, or what is your opinion of Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter? What have you seen? What have you not seen? What are some of the limitations that you believe might be in place to throttle your voice there?
I think it's mostly been positive. Obviously, he hasn't allowed back everyone, and that's questionable. And there's other things with the algorithm. A lot of people complain about the algorithm and like the platform itself not running as smoothly as before. But you're far less likely to be banned now, and you're also more likely to get your account back. Now, there are exceptions to that where people are not allowed back and they're not able to spread their voice on Twitter. But I think it's largely more positive. I do think that sometimes conservatives are a little bit too enthusiastic about Elon Musk because, like, Elon says a lot of good things. As I said in my speech, you know, he is bringing this color of crime aspect to there, and he shares a lot of other edgy content. But, you know, they're a little bit too fangirling for Elon. At any moment, they're like, Elon, please retweet me. Elon, they're like always in the mentions, always trying to be the biggest Elon fan. But largely, I think it's much better. Outside of performance, the performance isn't as good, but a lot of people worry less about getting banned than they did before. But at the same time, there are still people he's not allowing on.
Hi, Scott. I agree with you 100% about what is a much bigger threat to Western civilization. 100%. It's the immigration issue. But where it comes to the trans stuff, the problem is normie, and it's also localism. So it's much easier to get normie to join our side and to start to detest the left when you show them the kinds of things they want to push on children. And I'll give you an example. Like locally for our school board, we were just barely able to keep it in conservative hands because we went around, knocked on doors and said, hey, this is what they want to keep in the schools by showing them pictures and stuff in the books that, and we just barely kept our school board in conservative hands to keep this garbage out of our schools. So it would have been a lot harder to convey them as to, well, you know, think about the Great Replacement or think about the long-term consequences of demographic change and all that. Would have been much harder to get across to normie in a few minutes of conversation, you know, at a door or across, you know, in a news broadcast or something like that. So how do you factor that into your analysis?
No, I think when it comes to schools, like the gender ideology is probably equal to what really upsets people as that. And that's actually one of the, you know, along with critical race theory, that's what's getting parents up there because they're teaching my kids to hate themselves because of the color of their skin. And they may be teaching my kid to change their gender. And that gets parents really worked up. It's when it comes to education, like that's obviously an issue that gets people worked up, whether it's gender ideology or whether it's critical race theory. But in some ways where it's not involving education, it's very outrageous. And it's, you know, it's definitely something that it's on Twitter or if it's on TV, people are going to get really worked up about. But when it comes to as a voting issue of like whether it's going to get people motivated to the polls, because there is this thing, you know, Michigan Republicans ran heavily on trans athletes and girls sports, which that does upset a lot of people, but it didn't work as a voting issue. Now, when you had gender ideology and education, that really helped out Youngkin along with that critical race theory stuff. So it depends on just what the parents are up to, you know, what's their direct issues. If parents are facing, you know, this insane stuff in their school, whether they're teaching transgender ideology or critical race theory, that's going to be their most direct issue because they're going to be worrying about their children. But as like a larger picture outside of the direct issues that are facing those parents, you know, you have to think outside of education and just like thinking about a random drag show that's happening that sometimes gets a lot more attention than the border. You just need people to focus more on. That's not to condemn people who are protesting and trying to remove gender ideology from their schools. It's just saying that conservative media focuses a little bit too much on that. And at times they focus on stuff that's outside of the direct experience of most adults or most people. And, you know, it gets a lot more engagement. It gets a lot more views. but at the same time, they have to remember what's important. So it's not saying that you should not focus on these issues at all or not talk about them. It's just a matter of people need to remember what's most important. But if it's like for a parent that's facing that direct issue in their school, they'd probably be more willing to say, well, this is what's really affecting me. I haven't really thought about that issue, but I know that this is in front of me and I want to advocate for that. And if that's the best avenue to wake them up to other issues, then, you know, I support that.
Hey, Scott, really enjoyed your talk.
All right. Thank you.
You know, one thing that you got me thinking about was how many people, TV Republicans, congressional Republicans, have actually joined our side on this. And I think it's something that is lost because a lot of us here on the vanguard of this, we don't really look back behind us to see who else has come. So you mentioned several senators and prominent commentators that have brought on immigration patriotism as something that they're interested in and taking a stand on anti-white racism, et cetera. What do you think the odds are? Well, I mean, you've got some people in Congress, so I don't think you're going to change Mitt Romney's opinion. I don't think you're going to change Mitch McConnell, what they think. So what can we do, or how do you see it progressing? Not really what can we do, but how do you see this movement affecting elections in the future to make sure that we get people who are on our side? We're not going to flip everyone, right? So I think that flipping is great, influencing, poking, prodding, pulling, however we do it, that's effective. But how do you see us getting new people, whether it's in media or in Congress, having an effect on the issues that matter to us?
Well, the one thing to have the most effect is ensure that the most influential conservative voices are reflecting our views, which that was happening with Tucker, which it's unclear if that'll still be maintained, if those will still be the issues. But, you know, there are several congressmen and senators, you know, they changed their views on this just by watching Tucker, and also the fear that Tucker would attack them. And it's also just a matter of who's also leading the Republican Party, is like who's the, you know, the main guy that everyone's wanting their endorsement and stuff. It's the same with, you know, Trump. You know, Trump has had some bad endorsements. He's had a lot of bad endorsements. But he's in general, if he's like picking between two people and somebody's wanting to reflect his agenda more, he's probably more likely to endorse that person. Not always in that time, but if it's you're having your new leader be someone like Tim Scott or Mike Pence, where they're just wanting to pick who's more electable, then you're not going to have the people in position you want. So I think, you know, some of those things are outside of our hands. It's like, well, ensuring that the main Republican leader is reflecting our views and ensuring the most influential voices in conservative media are reflecting our views. The most we can do is support them and show, you know, ensure that they have the most traffic and everything like that. But for us, it's like just to keep getting that message out there. And when you have Elon Musk and other people who have these massive platforms, you know, sharing that message, you know, there's several people who have never even heard of the color of crime that would have never even been aware of those statistics if Elon hadn't shared them. And you're still having that guerrilla, I guess, journalism effect. I don't know if that's the correct word, but that guerrilla effect that back in 2016 around Trump's campaign, that there was all these people online who were getting this message out that people had never heard before and were interacting with. And you're now having that return a little bit with Twitter and some of the other social media that's happening. I mean, social media is backing off a little bit from censorship. Obviously, that can return, but there's now more freedom to express these ideas and to make people think about them. And so I'm seeing more progress. There are these challenges to ensure that the most influential voices in conservative media don't revert back to pre-Trump days, as well as the main figurehead for Republican Party doesn't switch back to the pre-Trump days.
Scott, just a quick question from the live stream viewers here. This is from North Country VDare supporter. He says, is the best heuristic for discovering any anti-white instincts of GOP politicians being if and how they engage with CNN and MSNBC? He says he asks because so many center-right politicians play a game of pretending to hate the liberal media while cozying up to it as soon as they think they can get away with it.
Well, it depends on how they treat this center-left media, the liberal media. If they're like having, you know, if they're offering them a town hall like Trump did, you know, that's free media. Why would you refuse that? They're, of course, going to give you tough questions, but you just got to be prepared for it and own it. So if you're interacting with them to gain more attention and a bigger audience for your message, then that's fine. But if you're going there to condemn Republicans and to condemn the far right, like Asa Hutchinson, always, you know, Asa Hutchinson is like the most popular Republican presidential candidate on MSNBC right now, for obvious reasons, because they just bring him on to condemn the other Republicans. Now, if you're doing that, that's obviously a bad, you're obviously untrustworthy, you're a rhino. But if you're going on there and you're always taking combative interviews and combative questions, and are they giving you a town hall, that's just a way for you to get a bigger audience and reach more people. So it's depending on how they approach that.
Is there any more questions?
You have any more questions from the...
All right. Oh.
Scott, good speech. You mentioned immigration versus other issues, like the trans, abortion, and other welfare issues that consume the GOP are important. Have you ever tried just saying that immigration will solve all other issues? Because every time an immigrant comes here and votes a Democrat, that is an indirect vote for every other issue that the Democrats vote. Because, you know, when we solve the immigration issue, we solve everything else because the progressives, they don't have that many numbers just by themselves. And so they're more and more relying on the immigrant numbers to support their pet issues.
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's a good way to frame it, because all the time they'll say, oh, these immigrants are natural conservatives. And they're doing this with Muslim immigrants now, too. But if you look at the way they vote, you know, overwhelmingly pro-choice, overwhelmingly pro-gun control, overwhelmingly, you know, pro-social liberalism all the time. It doesn't matter what they're, you know, it's good what they're protesting at these school boards at. But when it comes time to the ballot box, they're going to be reliable Democratic voters, reliable, you know, supporters of the liberal agenda. And that's a good way to frame it, to win over conservatives, to say, if you have any hope for conservatism, or if you, you know, you're very much concerned about this other issue, say guns, gun rights or whatever, you're going to lose your gun rights if we still have mass immigration, if we still bring in millions of people here, because they're all going to vote for gun control. So actually, I think that, yeah, that's a great way to pitch this to normie conservatives who maybe aren't aware of this issue, or maybe are reluctant to fully embrace it, but just to say, well, whatever issue you care about, even high taxes or, you know, socialism, that's more likely to be enacted thanks to mass immigration than anything else. So
that's it. I think that's good. Thank you.
Thank you.